and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show, KTAR News, 92.3 FM, and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. Sometimes the headlines tell the story. Other times they're just an indicator. Let me give you a headline. Households are now spending an estimated $5,000 a year on gasoline. That is up about $2,800, and $3,800 as recently as March. So a year ago, we spent $2,800 less than we do now on gasoline in the average American household. Just start there. When it comes to housing, I want you to hear Brian Carberry, rent.com, rental rate increases across the valley, and then we'll talk specifically about the city of Chandler.
Prices are going up, and that's pretty much what we're seeing across the country. If you look at, you know, the sizable cities in your valley area, it really sets two-bedroom for Scottsdale is the only thing that we're seeing a decrease. Phoenix itself is relatively flat. For a one-bedroom apartment, you're only looking at about a 1.5% increase, but it's a 10% increase for two bedrooms. In Mesa, it's an 8% increase for a one-bedroom. Chandler's a 5% increase for a one-bedroom, but other than that, we are looking at these double-digit rent increases.
The city of Chandler, number one nationally for increase in two-bedroom rent, up $2,900, 68% year-over-year for the month of April. So why is that? Let's just think about why that would be. Now, I would say to you, it's because of demand. And we laugh and say, okay, that's a very simple answer. If you have families, and many of these people, that's why they have multi-bedrooms. Some of them are obviously roommates. But if you have a family, and they are in the market to buy a home, or at least they're trying, so they're renting, they're saving, they got to make a down payment. Well, they can't. Interest rates are pricing them out. And we all understand, if you're getting a mortgage, that your payment is dictated partially, not just by the cost of the home, but the interest rate you pay, what your monthly payment will be. And lenders look at your credit score, but they look at your debt to income ratio. They look at how much money you make versus how much money you owe every month, and then factor in your ability to make that mortgage payment. And there's a cap for every, I would say for most people that get a mortgage, there's a cap on how much a lender is thinks you are able to pay based on your debt to income ratio. So it's not just your credit score and your payment history. If we add this mortgage, are you easily going to be able to, or simply going to be able to make that mortgage payment? It's how they factor it in. And when the interest rates go up, your payment goes up, which means the price of the home that you qualify for can go down. Not only that, coming up with a down payment, when more and more of your money is being spent on gasoline and rent, we understand that people don't have the discretionary income to set money aside to move out, which means there's a glut in the rental market for multi-bedroom dwellings. I lived in a two-bedroom apartment. I didn't need it. I was living alone. Before I bought my home, I had a two-bedroom apartment, but I made the choice to get a two-bedroom apartment in case I had family or friends over. But under the current circumstances, people that can live alone do live alone. But now that you can't live alone, you get a roommate, or you've got a child or children that are now sharing a room. And there's no end in sight. There's no end in sight with this. So Patrick DeHaan from Gas Buddies was on with me, with Gas Buddy, I should say. I asked him out of the gate, are we going to see $6 a gallon? Here's what he said.
Phoenix now at $5.03 a gallon. Arizona average $4.83. Tucson at $4.48. You know, Phoenix obviously is $6 a gallon, is still 97 cents away. So I'm hopeful that, you know, we'll be able to avoid that. But there are some things that worry me. So I'll say it's not impossible. But at this point, I still think it's very unlikely that Phoenix would get there.
The CEO of Wells Fargo said there is no doubt that we are headed to a downturn in our economy. Patrick DeHaan, how long are we going to see these gas prices go up? We know going into the Memorial Day weekend, it is the summer kickoff. Memorial Day weekend is classically that long weekend where summer travel begins. I asked him, is this just up until, are we only going to see prices go up through Memorial Day or June, July? How long do you think?
Quite possibly through the summer. And a lot of this is going to be contingent on Russia's oil, when it could make it back to the global market. And of course, with Russia fighting actively in Ukraine, that's something that may not happen soon. So we could be stuck with a high and rising prices for some time.
So we are seeing profits plummet in Target and in Walmart. I talked about this earlier. This is where the unraveling begins sometimes. I am not a fearmonger, and I certainly don't wish this on people. I've been very clear about this. my political leanings are always to the right, especially fiscally. I am fiscally very conservative. This is why I am an anti-big government person. Ronald Reagan, famous quote from Ronald Reagan is, we don't have inflation because we are living too well. We have inflation because the government is living too well. And reducing that was the other quote on Inauguration Day. So we spent 4 years of the Carter administration. I was a very young boy then when Carter took office. And we had high inflation throughout those 4 years. I remember it from a young boy's perspective in the gas lines and my parents talking about it. And the word inflation didn't mean much to me, but that was the big talk. On Inauguration Day, with Jimmy Carter sitting there, Ronald Reagan said, in this current crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem. And began dismantling a lot of what the government involvement was in the size of our government. And it took some time to turn the ship around. But ultimately, he won re-election by winning 49 states and turning around the United States economy. Not only in turning around our economy, but turning around the patriotism of American exceptionalism. We are the shining city on the hill, the world's last best hope. I quote those all the time in talking about America. Because Ronald Reagan didn't speak to political parties. Ronald Reagan spoke to Americans. Ronald Reagan spoke to the world when he stood in Berlin and he stood and said, Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. Talking about East and West Germany and bringing down the wall and freedom to other parts of the world, striking up a relationship with the Pope at the time, who was Polish, and the Polish people and their freedom fight that was going on, and the great speech he gave about the light of freedom in the window. And all of these things were about exceptionalism and self-reliance and self-sufficiency. That was the message then. And it was a great message, but it was one that was much needed at the time, because we went through 4 years of horrible, horrible inflation, and it's dragged down the American economy, and it took a long time to right that ship. We are looking at a situation now where, let's be honest, 2 years ago, we would have never, even with COVID, we would have never talked about the word recession. Climbing out of COVID, we saw with after the vaccine was readily available, during the Biden administration, they brag about the increase in the economy and the jobs added. We were watching our economy start to turn back on and grow again. Now we're talking about recession. We're talking about a recession. And I will submit to you that the energy policies of the U.S. and the policies of climate change and the direction going, or every direction we take, comes out of the prism of electric vehicles and alternative fuels and energy independence through electric, wind, and solar. And that's our goal. Is why things I want you to. I'm going to have to wait. I'm going to have to do this later. I have a cut from John Kerry saying the goal of how soon before we'll have all electric vehicles. And that's what they're working toward. This is part of the problem. We're going to do more of it later, so I'll let you hear it when we do it in just a bit. In a moment, we're going to talk about Roe v. Wade. I talked a little bit about this earlier, but it is a topic. Is it economic? Could people really connect abortion to the economy in a way that the American people see it that way? I'm not so sure, but you'll hear one Arizona Democrat say it. We'll do it next.
Strong values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
I want to congratulate Kimberly Kurth from Phoenix. She won $100 as part of our 100 Days of Giving. We're doing this through our anniversary in June. We're giving a listener each day during the week $100 and $100 to the charity of their choice. She chose Bat World Sanctuary is the charity. So if you want to get in on this, just text the number 100 to 411-923. That's 100 to 411-923. I want you to hear Greg Stanton. He is a congressman here in Arizona and is talking about the importance of Roe v. Wade staying intact for our economy.
Anything done more to help women gain the footing in the workplace and advance professional careers and advancement, which has been great for the American economy. So Roe v. Wade has benefited everyone in America, whether they know it or not, whether they even appreciate it or not, because it was part of the feminist movement, but that made it clear that, like, we need the talent of women in the workplace, and that's been a great benefit to our entire country and our entire economy.
I just listened to that, and I think it's a leap. It's a stretch. I am also a champion for women in the workplace. I've been very honest about this. My mother was a single mother raising three kids and worked three jobs at some time in her life. And then she worked for 27 years, I think, at a hospital group before she was able to retire, raising three boys and doing it on her own. This idea that there's a disrespect for women and people that don't want Roe v. Wade want to keep women barefoot and pregnant and stay in the kitchen, it's an absurd ideology. But the idea that you're helping the economy, and this is a defense of keeping abortion legal, it takes all of the focus over what the core of the argument is about life. When does life begin? And that, for me, is the biggest issue for all of us. And I think if we had a conversation about it, as reasonable as it could be, and if you look at some of the biggest defenders of abortion, I'll go with people that are also pro-choice but are not big defenders. I'll get to them in a moment. The biggest defenders on abortion don't even acknowledge that this is ever a life. Because they realize if they get into the life conversation, there's going to be differing opinions of when life begins. For some people, it's at conception. For other people, it's when there's a heartbeat. And so there's a lot of these conversations that are happening. And then when you start talking about when it becomes a life, and this is where, for me, it's bothersome, is because if it's a pregnancy that you want as a parent, as a grandparent, as a loved one, then it's a baby. And if it's a pregnancy that you're planning on terminating, it's just a medical procedure and it's a bunch of cells. If that's the way you feel, then you don't get to dictate when life begins. I just say that respectfully. If you have to really think about when it becomes a life, that's where the conversation begins and ends for me. But there are many people out there that are defenders of Roe v. Wade or defenders of abortion rights that are pro-choice that begin the conversation by saying, I wouldn't do it myself, but I don't believe I should tell other people what to do, which is a viable argument in this. Arguing with them or having the conversation with them about why they wouldn't do it. Is this, when does life begin in your mind? In your mind, when does life begin? Is it at conception? Knowing that if you don't interrupt this pregnancy, that it is going to end in the birth of a child. And then we start getting into the conversation of rape and incest and about the life of the mother. And I understand that argument as well. And it is something that has to be dealt with on the topic. But none of what we're talking about or what I'm talking about right now is economic, is driven by the economy. That seems to me to be the most callous argument of all in all of this, because if we're arguing about when life begins, what difference does it make? You know, I've talked about never having been to China. It was something I learned quite a bit about when I was younger, about the rules on childbirth in China and how girls were often seen as second-class citizens in China, and that they would abandon children, that daughters would be born, and when a baby was born female, that they were abandoned. And there have been a lot of organizations that set up orphanages in China where babies are just dropped off with no knowledge of what family they came from. And the reason why is because families wanted boys and there were a limit on how many children you could have. And we would look at that as Americans and say, that is horrible. How can you abandon a child to die in the elements? If it weren't for an orphanage, what would you do? And I don't know how far off we are from some of the people in this country right now, the loudest voices on abortion rights. This isn't about a medical procedure. This is, we hear people that won't put, not even discuss a limitation on when an abortion can happen. And I just wish we could have the conversation with each other about when life begins. I think if we had a civil conversation, when I say to you, this is where I believe it begins, and you say, I disagree with you, I believe it begins here. That's where the conversation should begin and end, in my view. And I don't like us moving away from that. coming up in here in just a moment, hate crimes. I talked about this a little earlier, but I want to go into more detail about hate crimes. The Anti-Defamation League, Southern Poverty Law Center, hate organizations, hate speech. How many are growing in Arizona? Is it really growing that fast? And are they limiting themselves to one political side of the aisle when they talk hate speech? We'll talk about that next.
Values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. Should you be punished more severely depending on the person that you commit a crime against? That's what hate crime is. It's an enhanced sentencing tool that if you commit a crime against a certain group of people, whether it's racially motivated or it's about sexual orientation, whatever, there are certain groups that are protected. Equal protection under the law, our system is supposed to be blind. If you look at justice in America, it's represented by Lady Justice standing, being blindfolded and holding a balanced scale. Now, we understand, and at least I do, I don't think that it's racial. I think it's economic. You know, reasonable doubt for a reasonable price should be the defense attorney slogan. And so we're not, that's not fair. But that's ultimately how it happens, whether it's some rich person that's white or non-white. You know, O.J. Simpson was a very wealthy man and put together the dream team of a defense team. Many people still believe and a civil court found him responsible, but not a criminal court. The reason why I ask this is that there is an increase in hate crimes, according to the Anti-Defamation League, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center in Arizona. Hate speech, hate crimes. And I will tell you, I identify hateful speech, whether you want to use the phrase hate speech or just hateful speech, differently. If you are attacking someone and you're not attacking something they said or an idea, but you're attacking them personally, I think that's hateful. You know, you have a right to say things, but that doesn't mean it's the right thing to say. When you cross that line, I think it's hateful. But when you marginalize people, and let's be honest, whether you're talking about the Holocaust, which we have, the rationale from Hitler and from the people in the Nazi Party was that Jews weren't really people. They weren't really people. They didn't have the same status of humanity as us. They were marginalized in that way. They were less than human. So it was easier to do away with them. It was better for us to do away with them. They did the same thing with disabled people, people that had a disability. You look in America when we had to change the Jim Crow laws, which we should have changed years and years and years and years before that, when we marginalized people that were non-white as in less than. Now, we understand in the context of the Constitution, the defense of how it was, but that's not how it was interpreted. It was interpreted as if that people could own other human beings. And then even after slavery was ended after the Civil War, the rules of black and white and where people of color, people of color had to have sleep or eat in colored, what they called then colored hotels and drink from colored water fountains and eat at lunch counters that were different from the white people. That is less than human. That is marginalizing someone and saying they are less than the rest of us. That's hateful. That's hateful. But we get now with the Anti-Defamation League and especially the Southern Poverty Law Center, the SPLC, that with them, with the problem with them is that we see that they look at one side of the political aisle and hate is hate. And whether you agree, and that's the problem with this, if you agree politically with someone, somehow what they say that's hateful isn't hateful. And that's just not the case. And so much of what we're watching now and what happened in Buffalo was a horrible crime because it was someone that was apparently out of his mind that had hatred toward a group of people based on the color of their skin or their faith. He hated Jews as much as he hated black Americans. And he traveled a couple hundred miles to kill people of a different race. That's hateful. It's absolutely hateful. But how is it not hateful for murdering someone because they're wearing a different color than you are? in gangs. You look at in gangs, and I'm not a gang expert by any stretch of the imagination. I can name four probably in the country. But when you look at gang violence, they hate each other based on the part of town they live in or based on the color of the clothing. You know, we grew up with the Bloods and the Crips and the, you know, that's when gangs became known to everyone, and that you literally were killed if you were in a neighborhood wearing the wrong color. Wearing the wrong color, not being the wrong color. We look at murders happening. We talk about the statistics on black-on-black crime. It's hateful. It doesn't matter what color the skin of the person is pulling the trigger if they hate you enough to shoot at you. This is the stuff we should be trying to end. And instead, we continue down this road of marginalizing each other. We continue down the road of demonizing each other. You know, I played earlier Donnie Deutsch on MSNBC saying that what the Democrats need to do to win the elections in the midterm is take this replacement theory idea, which is the theory that that Anglo-Saxons that came to America are being replaced by other races. That's the replacement theory. And so people that believe that are racists, and so everyone in the Republican Party should be labeled as a racist. That's what Donnie Deutsch said, that if the Democrats want to win these elections, they should label it the Republican Party replacement theory. And that's how you win elections. But what you're doing is taking someone like me, who honestly, I have no hate in my heart for anyone because of the color of their skin, their sexual orientation, their political views. I don't hate anyone. And I will tell you from personal experience, the vast majority of people in my political party feel exactly like I do. Exactly like I do. We judge people based on their behavior and based on what they do and what they say, not on how they look. But that's the marginalization I'm talking about. You begin there. You begin by saying those people are the fringe. Those people are crazy. An entire political party is racist, which is what Katie Tour goes on to say, talking about that white nationalism has now become the mainstream of the Republican Party. So if you want to go down the road of marginalization where it's easy for me to lock you up, to lock you down, to not give you opportunity, to commit acts of violence against you and get away with it, it's because I've marginalized you. You're less than me. We are superior to you. That's how it starts. And then you equate them to being dangerous. And then we have to lock them up or kill them. And it doesn't matter how it's happening. It's hateful. And so these stories, and the reason why I brought this up and I've talked about it twice on the show today, is I think we have enough distance. I think we have enough differences. I think we have enough division that maybe what we ought to be talking about is common ground, that every parent wants to raise a child in a safe environment and give them an opportunity to succeed. If we start there, then it doesn't matter what color anybody's skin is. And we can work together. But the idea that I'm predisposed to dislike someone because of the color of their skin or their sexual orientation or identity is a fantasy. That's just not true. And marginalizing me because I disagree with you politically and putting me in those categories does no one any good. And I just, this hate speech, hate crimes that's meant to protect people, what it does is it further divides people. And I wish we did it differently. I wish we did it differently. Coming up in a moment, we talk about the border issues. We had Brandon Judd on with us. He is the head of the Border Patrol Council, and it's about to expire. Are we prepared as a nation? Are they prepared as a law enforcement agency for what will happen if Title 42 expires? We'll talk about that coming up in just a moment.
Values and strong opinions. The Mike Broomhead Show. KTAR News, 92.3 FM and the KTAR News app.
Hey, thanks for being here. About a half of the people that were brought into this country or walked into this country and made contact with border agents, about half of them remain in this country at 118,000 people last month. That number is expected to increase dramatically if Title 42 ends. So we asked Brandon Judd to come on the show. Brandon Judd is the president of the Border Patrol Council. And I asked him, are you prepared for what is going to happen if Title 42 expires?
From an enforcement standpoint, absolutely not. There's nothing that you can do to deal with 18,000 illegal border crossers. From a standpoint of just releasing people into the United States, yeah, that's what this administration is geared up for. They've geared up to move people through the process quicker to release them. That can be done, and that's what this administration is going to do. But from an enforcement standpoint, to stop people from crossing the border, to actually effectively enforce our laws, no, we are not prepared.
So we're not prepared to enforce our laws. So I asked him, I said, let's talk about this process. What happens when someone crosses the border illegally, confronts a federal agent, and says that they would like asylum? What then happens?
Somebody crosses the border illegally. We respond. We take them into custody. We take them back to the stations. We process them under Title 8 and put them in deportation proceedings. We then turn them over to ICE. They can claim a fear at any point in this process. They can claim a fear the moment we take them into custody. They can claim a fear once we turn them over to ICE. But once they claim a fear, we then have to refer them to an asylum officer that falls under Citizens Immigration Services. And once they claim that fear, we then have to release them because CIS doesn't have enough asylum officers to interview them right there on the spot.
So I asked him about the numbers. I said, you know, the number I had always been told is ultimately when the proceedings get to their final, you know, final hearings, that about 90% of the asylum claims in the U.S. right now are false. They are deemed to be false claims. Only about 10%. He said it depends on who you ask. What his group would say 7%. That's what his consultants say. Others say it's 14%. So you go somewhere in the middle and it's around 10%. But let's say it's 14%. Let's say it's 14%. That means 86% of asylum claims in this country right now are false claims, which means the overwhelming number of people that are seeking refuge in this country legally are waiting years for their hearing date because of what's happening. A more indication of the humane way we're treating people at the border. These border policies are failing everyone. They are failing legitimate asylum seekers. They are failing the illegitimate asylum seekers. They are failing them as well because they're staying in this country a temporary amount of time and then they're set up for deportation, which usually doesn't happen anyway. And they remain then after their visas have expired, after their work permits have expired. They remain in this country under false pretenses and really relegated to second class status, which we can't allow under our Constitution. The cartels are the only ones that are benefiting. Over and over and over and over again, we're talking about this. There has to be accountability on the issues. At some point in this country, we have to talk about the issues. We have to look at the intended results and the actual results and then make decisions based on what's going to happen next on those results. It's the way every successful business runs, whether it's an athletic team or whether it is an actual profitable business. You bring in leadership, let's say the head coach of a team that has a game plan, and it sounds like a great game plan. This is what we're going to do on offense. This is what we're going to do on defense. This is what we're going to do on special teams. And this is what's going to make us successful based on the players we bring in, based on the players that we have. Let's go get them. And everybody loves the idea. Everybody loves it on the way in. And after a season or two seasons, we find out that those plans sounded terrific. But in practice, they were not producing results. What happens in the NFL? That coach is gone. Because success matters. How many seasons does a head coach get to before they're not showing improvement before they are gone? We see it happen all the time. Starting quarterbacks, people in charge, leadership. That's why the NFL is a successful organization, because they expect excellence. And if you're not excellent, you're moved. In this country, when it comes to politics, we turn it into the cult of personality. And it isn't about results. It's about intent. And it's about if we like you. It's about all of those things factor in. And it's why we are seeing a lack of success in this country. Both parties should be held accountable for what they say they're going to do, if they actually do it, and if the intended results happen. If we did that, we'd be a much more successful nation. This is on the electorate, too. We elect people we like and not people that do the job. Coming up just after 11 o'clock, we're going to talk about education. I want to get into this because I was at an event last night where I watched students, excellent students. We're going to talk about the fallout of not having excellence next.